Across the white painted steel of the archway, over the bridge that crosses the Alabama River, big black capital letters spell out Edmund Pettus Bridge. In 1960s Alabama, Edmund Winston Pettus was a leader in the Ku Klux Klan. But that isn't why he had a bridge named after him. At least, I couldn't find anything that would say that. The bridge was named for his military service. He was a Confederate general. If you were alive in 1965 and old enough to be aware of, maybe even involved and active in the struggle for civil rights, or if you have recently seen the film Selma, you know the bridge. You can probably even call to mind the image of Edmund Pettus's name. The moment most people remember and talk about under that Klan leader's name came on Sunday, March 7th, when nearly 600 African American marchers attempted to make their way to the state capitol in Montgomery and claim their rights as equal citizens. Greeting the marchers on the other side of the bridge was a long line of white state troopers and local police. The police, as they greeted them, said, "You have 2 minutes to disperse," but then waited only 1 minute before heading into the crowd on horseback. They swung with clubs and threw cans of tear gas. Women and men of all ages were brutally beaten and trampled. And all of it was captured and broadcast immediately on television. It was 1965. There weren't that many channels, right? There was certainly not the hyper-sensationalized drama that we have today, where it's so hard to break through. 48 million people, many of them white people, experienced in their living rooms the great and desperate urgency of life as it was unfolding right then for black Americans. An urgency that up until then had been mostly, for many of them, theoretical, worthy of serious consideration and study, sure, but now it was real. Bleeding and real, heartbreaking and immediate. Martin Luther King Jr. sent the telegram at 4:57 a.m. the next Monday morning. "Come to Selma. Clergy of all faiths, come to Selma." And within a few days, nearly 200 Unitarian Universalist clergy and members of our congregations showed up in response. By the end of the week, I've read that about 10% of our people were present. The sense of entitlement and rage on the faces of the white police officers, the force of their blows, the hysteria, the fall of the women hitting the concrete, the fractured skull of John Lewis. These images had to have been so powerful, so overwhelming. They inspired many who had been slumbering to wake up and respond. As we approach the 50th anniversary of that bloody Sunday, these and many other images of loss and terror still shake us awake and move us to ask more of ourselves, of our faith tradition, and of our religious communities than we have ever asked before. Especially in light of the too many recent stories of police officers shooting people of color, including just this last week in Denver with the shooting of 17-year-old Jesse Hernandez. It is impossible to hear these stories and not think of that bridge and on that Sunday and all that has been sacrificed. Impossible to see these images and hear these stories, and as a faith tradition that stands firmly in our commitment to racial justice, not feel a call to respond. And yet this is not the image I have been most seriously wrestling with since I saw the film 2 weeks ago. The one that has stayed with me most comes later, 2 days after Bloody Sunday. Dr. King assembled clergy and religious leaders, justice seekers and freedom fighters, by then 2,000 of them with him, and went again to the Edmund Pettus Bridge. There was a pending court order forbidding them to march. The president had asked them not to march, but King had called them. They'd come all that way from all across the country. And so on Tuesday, March 9th, with Dr. King leading the way, they marched. And once again, they saw in front of them the line of white officers ahead of them. But this time, Dr. King paused. And it's this pause that I keep thinking about. He paused, and everyone around him paused. All of them, like this huge line of dominoes. And then Dr. King knelt down, and everyone else knelt down. King bowed his head, and everyone else bowed their head. And they prayed. A few moments passed, and then he stood up, and then everyone else stood up. And then Dr. King turned around and walked back through the crowd the way he came. There was quiet, confusion, but then everyone else turned around and left as well. I find this moment so fascinating and important. For all the stories that we tell about Dr. King or other great leaders, we don't usually tell about the times when they turned back. And I was wondering, you know, how many times did Rosa Parks not decide to resist sitting in the back? There had to be many. For every moment of showing up and marching forward, there are in all of our lives countless other moments where we retreated and went back, where we went a different way, or we didn't go at all. And we don't talk about these moments, which means we also don't talk about the tools that we use for deciding whether or not to go forward or turn back, respond or ignore, lean in or withdraw. The tools, we don't talk about the tools, or we don't talk about what the tools are trying to assess. But we should. Today we begin a new month, and as we do, we turn our attention to a new theme, purpose. As in, what's your life's purpose? Writer Margaret Wheatley says that most of us yearn to experience a sense of purpose, that feeling of life working through us, of believing there is a reason for our existence. Now, last Sunday, I spent a little time with our youth who are here with us this morning. We talked a little bit about purpose and some of the ideas. We read the quotes that they shared with us from our sung response earlier, and we ended up talking especially about the one from Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. The world needs people who have come alive. I mean, we all have stories of signing up to do something and then our heart isn't in it, or we don't have the skills or the time. We might have thought it was the right thing to do, but if we don't have the love or the gifts or the capacity, then it isn't ultimately going to work. It doesn't align with our sense of purpose. And we're probably, in turn, getting in the way of someone else who does have the love or the skills or the time from fulfilling their purpose. These ideas led us to conclude that the first question that we might ask when thinking about purpose is, what do I love? What do I care about? Again, what makes me come alive? From our individual sense of purpose, we inevitably turn to our shared sense of purpose. We are, after all, relational beings. So what do we love? What makes us come alive? When I was in my first year of seminary, I had to write a reflection paper on the purpose of church for today. I was in this phase of my life where I wasn't so sure about church at all. But the essay was required, and so I had to figure out a way to do it. I decided to think of it like, if the church is going to exist, if church is going to be a thing, then what could and should it be helping our world to address? I still have those moments. Maybe you do too. So you just ask yourself, like, if it's going to exist, I think it's going to. So if it's going to exist, what could and should it be addressing in our world? Our recent and ongoing appreciative inquiry sessions, as well as the conversations that will run throughout the search process, and if we're doing it right, what we're talking about all the time in our congregation, direct us to consider these sorts of questions. We clergy often use the term discernment to describe these questions related to our individual and communal sense of purpose. Now, discernment is different than decision-making. It's less about thinking and more about listening. It's like taking all of your values and relationships, your gifts and your heartbreaks, your longings and dreams, and then sifting through them with your heart and your breath and your gut. Discernment implies a certain kind of surrender to possibilities that may not be your idealized life and yet may ultimately facilitate a more fulfilling life, the life that is just yours to live. Here is where clergy and others will talk about feeling called. Though I was skeptical of this term when I first heard it, over time I have come to understand it not necessarily as describing a voice speaking from a burning bush, for example, but as living within that place that Frederick Buechner describes as where your deep gladness and the world's great hunger meet. Or your deep gladness and the world's great hunger meet. Discerning your call is a process of stripping away the ego and the shoulds and the attachment to particular outcomes. Again, listening for something beyond your conscious personal knowing, for something mysterious and connected to a larger truth and goodness and love. And listening like this doesn't come naturally or easily for most of us. Our analytical brains, our self-judgment or fear, our doubt or cynicism gets in the way. We have to be taught, and we have to practice, and we have to keep up the practice. If you regularly meditate or pray, you have a sense of what I mean. Or if you've been in one of our soul circles where we practice deep listening. Or maybe you have another practice where you intentionally listen to something beyond your conscious thoughts. Many things can take on a meditative quality if you practice them contemplatively. My sister and I, we were both swimmers growing up, but whereas she would talk about her back and forth laps in the pool as meditation, I just called them a way to win the race. Whatever practice we take up, it is important to acknowledge that a lot of the time, it may not feel like it's working. There's a lot of clutter and distraction and attachment to outcomes, and listening is sometimes the least accurate term for what we're up to. But if we keep at it, it can be like a channel starts to open up, a deep feeling of connection and belonging, a feeling that can serve us like a compass for our lives. Allow us to hear and stay on track with our life's great purpose, that feeling of life working through us. This is what I take the pause on the bridge to be. Martin Luther King was very open about his prayer practice. David told the story of his kitchen table prayer a couple weeks ago, that moment where King, in a moment of prayer, gained the strength and clarity to keep going. When King first paused in the film, when I was watching, I thought it was like that. I thought that's what was going on. Like, he just needed to be strengthened so he could move forward. I can only imagine, right, how terrified he must have been. How it must have felt to be on the front of that line with 2,000 people with him this time. Having that responsibility, having called all these leaders in, and then seeing in front of him those same white officers. But that wasn't what he was doing. He wasn't seeking reassurance. He was listening. And everyone around him, all 2,000 of them, were listening. As a group of religious leaders, we might predict they would have some experience in pausing like this, but I mean, also they were human beings, frustrated and angry and hungry for change. We would understand if rather than pausing, they would have rushed in. If they would have gone in pumped up with adrenaline or anger or ego or righteousness, it would have been understandable. But something, when he paused to listen, when they all paused, something felt off. Something felt inconsistent with what the movement was about. Not just the ends, but the means. Maybe the potential for additional violence was unnecessary, he felt. Maybe turning back might bring success just as well as moving ahead would. So why persist? Maybe there had already been enough sacrifice. Whatever he felt in that pause, connected to something greater, in tune with a flow of agape love, King decided to turn back. And they all decided to turn back. We don't know what would have happened if King would have crossed the bridge, or if some or all of those who were with him that day would have decided to go on and cross the bridge without him. Maybe it would have all turned out the same. Maybe it would have been peaceful this time. Maybe President Johnson would have still sent the voting rights bill to Congress a few weeks later. We don't know. We can say the walk across the bridge was finally completed a few weeks later on March 21st, after the court sanctioned the march and sent the National Guard and the FBI to protect the marchers. And we can say that the Voting Rights Act was signed into law just 5 months later. And we can say that the questions of civil rights and democracy, especially in light of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, remain as urgent today as they were 50 years ago. We face a moment on the bridge more often than we likely realize. The path before us often feels inevitable, and we forget we have a choice. Or we feel the force of truth and righteousness at our back and the stares and weight of many counting on us. Or we begin to awaken to a new call before us and we're trying to figure out how to begin. In these moments, these turning points, let us remember Dr. King not just for his marching, but also for his pausing. Not just for the movement he led, but also for the standing still. For the connecting to something larger. This is what we can offer each other and the world, what we can lead as a faith community. And as we do, so may we all live into a deeper sense of purpose, for that place where our own gladness meets the world's needs. For this is where we are called. Amen. Blessed be.